So what we're going to talk about today is, as I mentioned, there are a number of really unique circumstances. Let me ask you, is there anything in particular, why did you take this afternoon, this beautiful afternoon, that you could be doing other things outside to come and sit in here? What was it that you that spurred your interest to come to this? Title of the seminar, okay. Anybody else have any? I mean, yes. Okay. So was it about the kids particularly? Yeah. You know what's unique is, and as I mentioned this morning, I've been doing this about 25 years, where I've had the chance to. Like I said, sit in people's living rooms and talk to them about their families. And these are not the things that many times, if you go into a lawyer's office, that they end up discovering, that they end up asking you about in depth, what's going on with your kids. But in reality, that's really critical, because a lot of those circumstances we talked about, you just can't leave a big lump sum to the kids. And one of the things that's very unique is we're living in a generation that's probably one of the most unique generations in history, because things changed after World War II, and the average family began to accumulate wealth or just some affluence that the average families didn't have before. And what that means is that we, one, have more things that we're leaving to our kids, but the form has changed too. In previous generations, the things that were being passed down, with the exception of the very wealthy, were things that were going to stay in the family. They were businesses or family farms or family homesteads. Today, if you think about what you own, with rare exception, most everything you own is going to be liquidated and turned into cash, and then distribute it to your kids. So the way I look at it now is we have now generations of beneficiaries that are like lottery winners. They're getting checks. And we've had almost a generation now to watch these beneficiaries and see what happens to them. And interestingly, the statistics are almost identical to lottery winners, because it's the same circumstance. They didn't work for this money. They didn't sweat for this money. They're just given this money. And I think the reason why we're seeing such horrible results, the results are that almost 90% of the beneficiaries will have little to nothing left 2 to 4 years after they inherit. It just goes through their fingers. And I believe that the reason that that's happening is twofold. One is because we've done a really poor job of preparing our kids to inherit. It just happens. We're gone, and there it is. And we don't really plan. We don't think about it. And the second is that once we are gone, we've done little to help guide them or give them direction. And what I found is that there are ways we can do that. There are ways we can help to solve some of those problems. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. And we're also going to talk about a little bit about what our responsibility is, because I assume that because you're here, you probably are at least have an orientation towards a Christian thought pattern or your believers. And if you are, then we have a unique view of things, and we're going to talk about that. So we're going to start off. Do you have my presentation stored back there? It should be on the computer. Okay. If you want to follow along on the outline, we're actually going to have some slides up here too. A little background first. There are three primary objectives that we have when we're involving ourselves in what we call planning for our estates, or planning for what's going to happen after we're gone. And these three primary objectives are, first, we want to try to eliminate or reduce as much tax as possible for our heirs. It's not going to affect us, it's our heirs. The second is we want to eliminate probate. Eliminate probate. And the third is that we want to be able to control our distributions, which means we want to be able to leave it to who we want, when we want, and how we want it. So we want to control how things are going to be done. We don't want someone coming in who normally wouldn't be inheriting. Okay, I'm going to wait for that to come up so I can track it and make sure we're filling in the blanks for you. And again, for those who didn't hear, forgive me for my voice, but I've had vocal cord surgery 2 days ago. But I was told that I can, I'm supposed to be talking, supposed to be using my voice. And this was important enough that I decided I was gonna come. So I have a flash drive if you don't have it. Let me get a copy and I can track with you too. Okay, so those three were the three issues: the tax, the probate, and then control the distributions. There are three different ways that typically we distribute. One is what's called the outright distribution, which used to be the most popular way to distribute, which is just you leave in your will or trust, I'm leaving it to this person, and as soon as it can be legally transferred to them, they get it. There's some problems with that, and one of the biggest today is that's the one that we're seeing the huge, what we call dissipation rates in, where we're seeing almost 90% of outright distributions are blown within 2 to 4 years. So someone created a little bit more control to try to help the kids a little bit more, and they called that staggered distributions, and staggered is a second, and staggered is just what it sounds like. You may give a third now, a third in 3 years, a third in another 3 years, or whatever increments you choose, but it's done over time. And that was a great strategy, and it would have worked well, except it doesn't solve the problem that financial maturity doesn't come just because someone gets older. Financial maturity comes because we are intentionally changing behavioral patterns. And if there's nothing there intervening, creating new behavioral patterns, you're going to have the same result. And so what we're seeing was the same result, except it was staggered. We'd see 90% of this distribution would be blown, and then the same thing would happen. And I've sat down and I've met with heirs and beneficiaries who have had this happen. And I've never talked to anyone who said, I planned on blowing my inheritance. But we always hear the same thing. They just said, I just kind of felt like I had this almost unlimited resource and I could do things that I wanted to do that I've always wanted to do. And I just did it. You know, I was going out for meals. I was going on trips. We were doing this. We bought this. We bought this. And then all of a sudden we stopped and turned around and it was all gone. And that's just the same story we hear over and over again. Okay. Move on forward a little bit. Another? Okay, let's talk about that for a second. This is back up under A, the eliminate tax. Fortunately, this is not going to be a big issue for us because currently the exemption, the amount that we have that we can accumulate before a dollar of tax, has moved up to $5.49 million this year per person. So unless you have over about $5.5 million worth of assets, you're not going to be subject to the estate tax. So most families don't have to worry about the estate tax, and that's a good thing. If you have more than that, then that's something that can be structured and we can actually combine your exemption with your spouse's exemption and combine that and pass on almost $11 million, which is a great solution. But right now, most people don't have to worry about that. Okay, next slide, probate. Probate is a It's different from taxes. People confuse probate and taxes. Taxes are levied by the government on what they say we've accumulated more than what they want us to accumulate. It's the IRS, the federal government, that does that. Whereas probate is a state-driven process of going through the court system. And it's designed to accomplish the goals of paying off the debts that we've incurred and then making sure that the proper people, the heirs, are the right heirs. There's a couple things that trigger probate in California. One is that we have to actually own something, and we own it in our name. If you own things jointly as a couple, all that that means is you're just delaying ownership in one name until there's only one person. So as one of you passes away, the survivor owns it in their name, and when they die, they fulfill the requirement of the probate ownership. So joint tenancy or joint ownership or community property really just delays the fact that one of you will end up owning it. Value, that's the other trigger. We must have both ownership and value for the probate to occur in California. And the value is determined by the type of property it is. We're deemed to have two types of property. One is real property, which is real estate. The other is personal property, which is everything else. It could be our things, our stuff. That's a technical legal term for our things. Our bank accounts, cash, all those kinds of things. Anything but real estate. And the values are different. In California, every state's a little different. California, you can only have up to $50,000 worth of real estate. That's the fair market value, not your equity, before it triggers a probate. That's a really low standard. I don't know of anybody who owns any real property in California that's less than $50,000. Personal property can be a little more. It can be up to $150,000. So that would be the bank accounts, it'd be all the other things that we own. So the idea is if your values are above those minimal values and you own them in your name in California, that will trigger a probate upon your death. And again, probates are not something we want. Going through the court system it's very protracted. It takes up to 2 years in many cases. It's supposed to take a year, but it doesn't. It's very expensive. It can run between 4% and 8% of the gross value of all of your assets. And it's also, everything becomes a public record where anybody can discover this. I just opened a probate about 2 months ago for a family, and immediately we started getting solicitations from realtors wanting to sell the property. And the family called me up and they were saying, why did you give our name to realtors? And I said, I didn't give your name to anybody. The second that it's filed, they have access to this information and it's all public record. And I said, so anybody who wants to go down and grab a copy of the probate listing can find out everything that was owned by that person. So we don't want to necessarily go through a probate. So next slide then talks a little bit about what we're going to do to try to avoid one. And the key is that we have to have both ownership and value. So I've created this little illustration that kind of tells you how do we get rid of a probate. And the most common technique, Cameron, can you give me just a little more volume so I don't have to try as hard? Thanks. The most common technique is in using what we call a living trust. And the way that we do that, what it does is it changes the ownership of the assets on paper. A living trust is kind of like a corporation. It exists on paper, but it's really you. It's just the people behind it who are managing it. And a trust works like a big bucket. And into this bucket, what we do is we transfer the ownership of our assets. So I will take my bank accounts and all of the money that I may have, and I'll retitle my bank accounts like I have mine now. They're titled David and Judy Harrison, my wife, as trustees of the Harrison Family Trust. Now, the trustee is the only one who has any control. I have the use, the manage, and management and enjoyment of all the assets I put inside the bucket. So I'm going to transfer my bank accounts in there. I'll let my keys illustrate my house. I'll transfer the deed to my house so that the deed will also say the same thing. David and Judy Harrison is trustees of the Harrison Family Trust. Now, if I want to refinance, I can refinance. If I want to sell, I can sell. I can do anything inside this bucket just like I could before. But the catch is everything that's in this bucket is now no longer viewed as legally owned by me. It's owned by my trust. So upon my death, this isn't a trick question, what do I own? Nothing, because the trust owns everything. So I've gotten rid of the one of the two requirements for probate, and I've done away with a probate. Now, after I'm gone, the trust functions just like a will, and it has beneficiaries, and it says, this is where I want all of my things to go. So it does the same exact thing. In fact, trusts and wills both come to us from the 1200s, so they've been around since medieval times, very effective ways of being able to transfer assets. So some people ask me, why do we hear so much about trust today, and we may not have maybe 20, 30 years ago? And it goes back to what I was mentioning earlier. As we become more affluent, as we begin accumulating more things, we begin to exceed those values again. And so as more people exceed the values, more people need to find a technique to avoid a probate. And so this is the cleanest technique. So that's what most people will end up doing, is they'll use a technique like a living trust to avoid a probate. And when you do that, it's considerably cheaper for the family, and it doesn't take 2 years to distribute the estate like it may under a probate. And it's also not a public record. Okay, let's move on to the next slide there. Okay, so we don't have the estate tax. We don't have a probate now. We've gotten rid of a probate by use of a trust. So then we want to talk about controlling distributions. And when we talk about that, now we're under the outline where it talks about major issues. And what we've found is that there are two things we want to try to do when we're controlling our distributions. One is we want to protect our children from themselves. And this goes back to the horrible waste that we see of them just blowing through the money. When we're protecting them from themselves, what we're trying to do is give them some assistance to keep them from really what it is impulsive spending, impulsive behavior. That's really what most people say is the response that causes them to go through their assets. The second one on there, the second major issue, is that we want to be able to protect them also from others. And the biggest one that I'm concerned about, quite frankly, is my kids going through a divorce where they may end up losing their inheritance. Because even in the church today, we're seeing that 60% of families are going through divorces. And I personally prefer to keep the inheritance that we may be giving to our kids in our own bloodline. And so that's one of the issues that we're trying to help. In the same sense, we also are trying to protect them from others, such as bankruptcies, lawsuits, judgments, liens, things like that where someone else can't come in and take it away from them. So I'm going to kind of give you a real quick overview about what you can do and some ideas of what you can do. And this is what I've done with my kids. And what I've done is based upon my watching a lot of families and seeing what works and what's been successful and what hasn't been. And I've tried to integrate into my plan what I've thought has been the most successful. So what I've decided to do is, after both my wife and I are gone, first of all, I've discovered that kids today are maturing at a much later age than even I was, or even younger, a generation younger than me. And part of that has to do with the fact that you mature and you develop responsibility by going through difficult times. And we're making things so easy on our kids. We're the term that's used now is we're rescuing the kids so much later into life that they're not experiencing consequences, and as a result, they don't learn responsibility. So what I've done for my kids to help in this system is that if I pass away and my wife passes away, they're not going to be able to have full control over their inheritance until they at least reach 35, because I want them to go through enough of life's experience that they have learned some of lessons. They've learned how to begin to try to take care of themselves and those kinds of things. And I feel like today, maybe it was 25 for those people who were in the Vietnam War era. But now it's 35 because we just have made life so easy for our kids. So that's what I've done. I've said, up to 35, I'm going to have a successor trustee, someone who's going to step into my shoes, and they're going to do whatever I would have done to help care for my kids, but they're not going to give my kids the opportunity to be making impulsive decisions and spending the money. So that means they'll step in and they'll help them for things like wedding expenses, if I would have done that, down payments, education, grandkids' education, things that I would have done if I would have been there. But it's not going to be turned over to the kids yet. At 35, then, I'm going to turn it over to the kids. But I have a couple of requirements that I'm going to put into place before I do that. And my requirements are not to try to control my kids from the grave. They're, again, to try to provide them with some guidance and some help and instructions so that they're going to have the tools to be able to manage probably the biggest windfall they're going to have in their lifetime. So the first thing I'm going to do is I feel like it's real important that kids become, that they get some education about money. And there's really not a lot of opportunities out there for them. So what I found is there's a couple of great courses that kids can take that help them to be able to get a step up. One of those is, if you're familiar with Dave Ramsey, it's called Financial Peace University. And this course is taught through churches, it's taught through community centers. It's what we call a crossover. It's both within the Christian community as well as in with the secular community. But it's an 8-week course, about 16 hours or so worth of education. They can even do it online. They can buy the course right online and do it online. So what I've required for my kids is that they go through either Financial Peace University, or another good one is called Crown Ministries Money Life Program. Same type of program, just a little bit more oriented for the Christian community. And they can do either one of them. It's their choice. But they have to take that one of those two courseworks before the my successor or my executor distributes the money to my kids. So they have plenty of time to do that if they're waiting until they're 35, for instance. Or once we pass away, it's going to take legally about 3 to 6 months to settle my estate. Just bills have to be paid. Things may have to be sold. And during that time is a great time for the kids to get this training. So they have some time to do it. But that's my prerequisite. Second thing I'm going to have them do is I found that there's just tremendous wisdom in the biblical concept of having a counselor or advisor, someone you can bounce ideas off of. And what I found that it does is it really slows down that impulsive behavior if they have to slow down and talk to someone before they do it. So what I require from my kids is that they have to appoint someone who will be their counselor or advisor that is going to have to hear what they've got to say about what they want to do with this money, and they have to approve it. So that does mean it's going to slow them down. Now, a lot of people have asked me, so well, that's a lot of restrictions for my kids. I don't think so, because what I'm trying to do is I analogize it to a speed bump. I'm trying to create speed bumps to slow them down, to say, I want you to be talking about these things. Now, they still have everything that they're earning. They have all the other. This is just the windfall of their inheritance that this will apply to. And it just slows them down enough to where they have to stop and think about something before they do it. They get to pick the person. It can be anybody they choose, as long as it's not someone they're deemed to have legal control over, which would be a spouse or a child or even a sibling. So it has to be outside of the realm of their immediate family. But I can tell them if I want them to have qualifications. And so I have. And this is, again, you can choose to do whatever you want to do, but this is what I've done. For me, I've said that my child can pick anybody they want to be an advisor or a counselor. But one, I want them to be a Bible-believing Christian. And the reason I've put that restriction on there is because I want my kids to have to talk to someone who has the same worldview that I have. These were the assets that God allowed me to accumulate. And I believe it's important that the person who's helping them spend this money have the same worldview. That's my requirement. I have a couple of kids that have pushed back on that because they're not walking with the Lord. And my response has been, well, okay, that's fine. If you don't want to do that, you don't have to do that. But it's my requirement, so you don't have to get the money either. You know, It's my gift to you. You don't have a right to this. And if you don't want to follow the little rules that I've set up, that's fine. They've said, okay. It really is not going to be a big thing for them, except there'll be someone who's going to have a Christian perspective. The second requirement that I have, first is Bible-believing Christian. Second is that they must have some background that enables them to be a good financial counselor. It doesn't mean they need to be a professional accountant or financial advisor. They could even, in my trust, I've even said, they could even have just qualified by going through Financial Peace University or the Money Life program. But I want them just to be someone that's just not off the street, that's my kid's best friend, that's going to say yes to everything. So that raises another question, because then I've also told my kids, I want you to be able to hire and fire, because I don't want you to hire someone who's going to say no to everything that you ask them. My goal is not to keep you from your inheritance. It's just to cause you to slow down and think about it before you do something silly. And so you get to hire and fire. And so my oldest son, who's probably the one I'm most worried about, actually said, so Dad, then what's to keep me from hiring and firing until I find someone who says yes to everything I ask? And my response is, nothing. I'm not trying to keep him from his inheritance. If he wants to circumvent these little rules and the structure that I'm setting up, he can do it. And he could, in effect, get to the money just as quickly as if it were an outright distribution. But the fact that he has to go through a couple of steps to do it means that it's going to slow him down and cause him to at least think. So when people say to me, this is way too restrictive, it's too much control, I'm just going to leave it to them, my response is, well, this gives them the control that if they want to, they could go and do the same thing. However, if they want to use it the way that it's structured, it can give them some benefits they can't get any other way. And here's the benefits. Remember, we go back to the two major issues. One, it protects them from themselves. It slows them down. Number two, it protects them from others. Because if they're deemed on paper not to have complete control over their assets because they have to talk to an advisor, then it offers them some what we call limited asset protection, meaning that in most cases, it will protect them from divorces, bankruptcies, lawsuits, judgments, liens, things where people can take it away from them. Now, that's as long as they keep it in their little, what we call their sub-trust. If they take money out, then they've lost all those protections because now it's their money. So if they decide to withdraw everything all at once, put it in the bank so they can spend it as they want, they no longer have the protections. Does that make sense? But as long as they keep it in that, then they have protections. So here's a little use that someone has done. This is a particularly effective for two circumstances that I hear about regularly. One of them is where you have a daughter where you're concerned about the son-in-law's influence because he always has these really great get-rich-quick schemes, and he always has a great way to spend their money. And if that's the case, then if the daughter has to talk to someone before she can take money out of her trust, that's her excuse for not being able to fund the son-in-law's get-rich-quick schemes. The second scenario is where you have that protection where I actually have had a couple of situations where kids have wanted to be able to purchase a major asset, but they wanted to have some protection for them. And the biggest one is a house. So again, where the child can use their subtrust as part of the down payment on a house, but if they keep it titled where a certain percentage of the down payment is owned by that subtrust, then if there were a divorce or a bankruptcy or something else that could happen, then that asset would still be, that portion would still be protected. Does that make sense? So it's a way of also shielding and protecting part of their inheritance as they use it for special things. So that's what I've done with my kids. It's just a suggestion. But what I've hoped to accomplish in that is those two things that I mentioned early on that we're not doing, that's probably one of the root causes of all this waste. And that one thing is we're not educating or helping them, giving them some information about how to deal with it. And secondly, we're not giving them guidance. Well, the guidance can be provided by the counselor. The education can be provided by the training courses that I mentioned. So it helps to do that. Okay, moving on. This is a big one. This is what are some of the obstacles we have? Now, one of the biggest assets that we're able to accumulate during our lifetime is going to probably be your retirement account. Because most people are not getting pensions today. They're not getting pensions through their work. So they're self-funding retirement accounts through IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, 457s. All of those are actually, in case you're wondering where those numbers come from, that's the section of the Internal Revenue Code that covers those particular plans. So that's where we get the names 401k, 403b. So next slide talks about some of the taxes. Our country was built based upon a revolution, partially based upon the taxes. And we remember the double taxation that was part of the big issue. Well, we get taxed on the same money over and over and over and over again. We get taxed when we earn it, that's income tax. We get taxed when we spend it, that's sales tax. We get taxed when we redeem an investment, capital gains tax. We get taxed when we die, estate taxes. And so that same money gets taxed over and over and over again. And again, moving on to the next slide, one of the biggest assets that we have is those retirement accounts. And those are actually the numbers up there. The distinction between a 403B and a 457 is that those are nonprofit organizations, they're the same as a 401k for a for-profit corporation. So if you work for a corporation, use an example, Apple, you'd be getting a 401k. But if you work for the state or for a charity or a nonprofit, it'd be a 403b or a 457. So it's the same thing, just different entities. So let's move on and we'll talk about the next one. These plans have built-in issues that we have to resolve. So first, when we talk about a spouse, if we have a 401k, I'll use a 401k or an IRA as an example. If I have an IRA and I die and I leave it to my spouse, which is the way that It has to be unless your spouse agrees in writing otherwise. My spouse has a unique privilege that no one else will have, and that's called a spousal rollover. The spousal rollover means, now, are you familiar with when you have to start taking distributions? Yeah, you can take distributions beginning at 59 and a half without penalty, but you have to start taking by, it's actually the April 1st after your 70 and a half birthday. So during that window, you can start anytime then, but you have to by 70 and a half. So if you die prior to the time when you've started your distributions and your wife and or spouse inherits, they have a choice that no one else has where they can either begin taking the distributions immediately with no penalty, even if they're under 59 and a half, or they can defer that and roll it over and just allow it to become like their own IRA. And then they wouldn't have to take until 70 and a half. Does that make sense? They have that no one else has that ability but a spouse. So if both of us are dead, both my wife and I are deceased. I've died. I left the plans to my wife. My wife has died now. Oh, by the way, interesting figure. IRAs are designed by the payouts, what we call the distributions. The minimum required distribution, which begins at 70 and a half, was initially designed based upon your life expectancy tables, mortality tables, they call them, to pay out the entire IRA over your life expectancy. So idealistically, if you lived your life expectancy, you would die and there'd be zero in your IRA. Does that make sense? That's what it's designed to do. But in reality, what's happened is if we end up making about 4 or 5 or 6% on those accounts, the payout's about 4, 5, or 6%. And I'm talking now to 95-year-olds who are saying that I've been taking since I was 60 or 65, and my IRA is as large as it was when I started taking it out. It's not going down. And so when you're thinking, oh, I'm going to spend this down, unless you're taking much more than the minimum required distribution, you're not going to spend it down. It's going to be left in your estate, and it's going to pass on to your kids. So that's what we're talking about here as the anyone else. These are what are called inherited beneficiaries. And when these inherited beneficiaries get it, they don't get the same option as the spouse. They don't get to defer it. They have to begin taking distributions the year of your death. So if it's the last spouse, if it's my wife and I, it's whichever of us dies the last. That year, my kids have to start taking distributions. And it's going to be calculated based upon now their life expectancies. So their minimum required distributions, let's say they're 40, is going to be much, much smaller because it's supposed to last their life expectancy than if they were 80 at the time they started taking those distributions. Does that make sense? Because it's, again, calculated based upon their life expectancy. So they have to start taking them. Now, they're given some options. And the options, assuming that I have already begun taking my distributions, they have two options. They can either take it out as a lump sum, or they can take it out over their life expectancy. Now, if I were to ask you what 90% of the kids would choose, what do you think they're going to choose? I want the money now. But what they don't realize is that all the deferred income tax that you never paid gets paid when they withdraw it. And so it's all due immediately, and it shoots them into the highest possible income tax bracket. And in many cases, we see those accounts being taxed between 40 and 45%. Now, an example of that. If we took I did a computer scenario. I took a 52-year-old who was inheriting his dad's $300,000 IRA. And he had those two choices, immediate lump sum or deferred over his life expectancy. And he chose to to take an immediate lump sum. So of the $300,000 after tax, he got a check for $166,000. So he lost almost half of it in immediate tax. If, oh, by the way, and it doesn't actually come like that. In many cases, most of the time now, they're requiring the tax be withheld because they figured out that if they don't withhold the tax by the next April 15th when the tax is due, the money is already gone. So instead, now they're withholding most of it. But if he chose to take it out over his life expectancy as a 52-year-old, he would have gotten almost $700,000 as opposed to $166,000. And the reason is because all that tax that he had to pay up front in the lump sum is compounding and earning interest. So he's actually making money on money that's not his. And so if we have a choice of what we want to do for our kids, what would we choose? Of course, we want to choose, let them take it out over their life expectancy. Now, in many cases, what this will be a part of the inheritance. They're already getting the house and whatever other assets that are not retirement accounts. This is something that I've chosen for my kids to structure it so that they're not going to have a choice in the matter because I don't want them being part of those high statistics that are making a horrible tax choice. Instead, what I've chosen for them is I found a way to structure it so they're going to get a check every year for the rest of their life. And as a result, they're going to get paid out, depending on how old they are when they get it. They're going to get paid out potentially three or four times what they would have if I had left the choice to them. Now, not everyone decides to do that. That's up to you. But the way we do that is through a newly created vehicle that we call a retirement trust. And what the retirement trust does, it's a separate bucket different than your living trust that's designed to do nothing but be the beneficiary of your retirement plans after both you and your wife are deceased. So what it says is after both of us are gone, the primary beneficiary of our retirement accounts are each other. So it will go back to the spouse always. But the secondary or contingent beneficiary is the retirement plan trust. And then the retirement plan trust, the only beneficiaries of it are my children. And what I've done in this is I've done a couple of things. As I've said, one, it will automatically structure it so that the kids don't have a choice. It's going to pay them out based upon their life expectancy annual checks for the rest of their lives. So it comes into the trust and it starts paying out these checks every year. The other thing it does that we don't have if we leave the accounts directly to the kids is we have that same limited asset protection that I talked about if the kids had those little sub-trusts where it won't be subject to divorces and bankruptcies and lawsuits. If we leave those retirement plans directly to the kids, then they could lose it to divorces or bankruptcies. And here's another little problem that we have in these. Retirement plans pass, just like life insurance, by beneficiary designation, which means we name who the beneficiaries are. Well, a beneficiary is a legal beneficiary when they turn 18. So I would gamble that probably everyone in this room who has a retirement plan has named their spouse as the primary and the children of this marriage or the kids by name as the contingent. Well, one of the problems I run into a couple times is your child has gotten married, has children, and has prematurely died. And their beneficiaries, if it's coming down my bloodline, their beneficiaries are not their spouse, it's their children. It's the biological bloodline that it follows. And so that means that a grandchild who turns 18 has the choice of a lump sum distribution from the retirement plan coming from granddad or grandma, or to take an annual distribution. So if you're talking about an 18-year-old, what do you think the chances there are of them making a good decision? There's none at all. So what this retirement plan trust does is it also structures and puts in the same age restrictions that I was talking about in the living trust. It says no beneficiary is going to get any benefit until they turn at least 35. Or if they get a benefit, all they're going to get is the annual distribution. Does that make sense? So it's solving three problems. It's solving them, the child taking a lump sum. It's solving the grandchild potentially standing and taking a lump sum. And then it's offering some asset protection. Now, the downside, the problem of this is you're creating a bucket, an entity that has absolutely nothing in it during your entire lifetime, because the sole purpose is to serve as a beneficiary after both of you have died. So it just sits there your entire lifetime. That's not really a downside, but it's something just to be aware of. The other downside is you're creating, you're having to pay to create a separate entity. And unfortunately, these are very very specialized trusts, and there aren't a lot of people that really draft these. It's usually a tax attorney that knows how to draft these, or someone who has been educated to do this. So they're a very unique thing. They cost, I've heard of, on the low end, they could cost $1,500. On the high end, I've seen some firms charge $5,000 for these. Now, if you're looking at that and you're talking about the fact that it potentially is going to save tens of thousands or perhaps even hundreds of thousands of mistake money that your kid could make, that's a good investment. That's not a bad deal. But a lot of people look at it and they say, well, I don't want to have to pay to create my living trust and my tax trust at the same time. That just is a lot of money to put out. It's all a matter of perspective. If you feel like the risk is worth it, then you do it. But just be aware that those are out there now. I do a lot of them. I have a private practice, and I feel like it's probably one of the, I feel the most comfortable about that, because I feel like that has the greatest potential risk for the kids of any single asset you have in your estate, because there's not a lot of ways to solve that. So now let's transition a little bit, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that we do, because we're here at a conference, and one of the things that I find that is probably the most disappointing to me is when I'm looking at people's and reviewing people's plans, what I find many times is that they're believers, but their plan is no different from their neighbor's plan that's not a believer. It doesn't reflect anything about their faith. It does nothing to recognize the Lord and the lordship of these assets. And that's something I've become even more and more aware of, more sensitive, is that these are things that God has allowed us to accumulate. And what we're called in Scripture is we're called stewards. Now, a steward is a really specific term. It's a term that we used to use, and everyone used to understand it. But we use another term today that probably is more modern, explaining what it is. And it's really a manager. It's like a money manager. A steward, if you remember the parables that Jesus talked about the stewards, where the master gave the steward some resources, and then he went away and came back and asked them what they did with this. The concept was that a steward was entrusted with resources that weren't his own resources. They were the master's resources, and he was to use those resources for the benefit of the master. Well, surprise, we're called stewards of the things that we're entrusted with during our lifetime. The assets that we're accumulating that we believe are ours are really not ours, they're God's. And I have on the next slide there, we'll move on to there it is. A bunch of passages. Normally I would go through these. I felt these passages are so important. I've memorized all of them. But what they talk about is God's ownership over things. A couple of them that I think are probably really important. The first one, First Chronicles, where it talks about yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty, for everything in the heavens and the earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor come from you, and you rule over all. In your hand are power and might, and in your hand is the power to make mighty and to give strength to all. It talks about everything is really God's. Probably the most disappointing thing that I run into is what I believe is, in our culture, what we call the self-made man. The person who believes that through his hard work and all that he's done, he's accumulated all these things. And it's interesting, if you look at, let me figure out which one that is. Deuteronomy 8, 17 and 18. It's really interesting because it says, beware lest you fall into the trap of believing that this is yours, and that you say to yourself, it is through my might and the strength of my hand that I've acquired all these goods. And it says, it is the Lord who gives you the power to accumulate wealth. It is not your own. And so we need to be really careful when we're looking at our assets and we're planning what we're going to do with these things, because as we're talking about the things that we own and that we have acquired, they're really the Lord's, and he's entrusted them to us for the purpose of glorifying him and building his kingdom. I sit down with families many times and I say, what is it you want to do with all of your assets after you're gone? What do you want? Where do you want them to go? And the most common response is, well, I guess I'm going to just divide them equally amongst my children. And I used to say, well, can I challenge you to pray about it and see if there shouldn't be a portion of that that you should carve off for the Lord's work? Because after all, this is all God's. And I sat down with a good friend who's in ministry, and he asked me one time what I do, and I told him exactly that. And I said, you know, I try to challenge people to think about, is there a portion that they should probably give back to God? And he looks at me and he says, you really say that? And I said, yeah. And he said, I would never say that. And he says, that's completely wrong. And I mean, he chastised me. And I said, really, what do you mean that's wrong? And he says, David, if we really believe God owns everything, why do we come to him saying, God, what portion of everything that you own should I carve off for you? He said, really, we should be coming to him and saying, God, this is all yours. What portion of this do I have permission to carve off for my family? Because remember what our biblical requirement for inheritance was? It was to help our kids get a start in life so they could have a means for making a living. And in most of our cases, by the time we pass away, living our normal life expectancies, our kids may be in their 60s or 70s. Hopefully, they've already learned how to make a living. We've already fulfilled our biblical requirement for inheritance. So what I'm looking at now is in my own life, as my kids get older and older, my wife and I are deciding that we have a sliding scale on our estate where we're saying a greater and greater percentage is going to the Lord's work, because my kids should be dependent less and less upon what I'm leaving them. And I think that's really more of a biblical perspective. I think it's something that it's between you and the Lord, but it's something you need to be thinking about. And that's kind of what the last part of the talk's about. I want to share one other thing with you. By the way, I have up here in the front, I have some books that I've personally picked. These are not my books, so I'm not selling my books. But there are two books that I think are probably two of the most helpful books that you could have if you wanted to put anything in your library. Provide and Protect is a book that talks about a lot of the principles we've talked about today regarding your estates, wills, trusts, all of that type of stuff. It's written by a Christian author, although he's written it for both a Christian and a secular audience. And we have these up here. if you don't have money with you, or you don't have money, period, to get something, this is a gift. I will give it to you. I buy these myself, but if you can help me, it costs me about $10 a piece for these. If you want to do that, if you don't, that's fine. You can just take it. The other book I have up here is Randy Alcorn's The Treasure Principle. And this is a really great book to help you understand, very short book, help you understand the biblical principles of what does it mean to have acquired things. Because we're in, you may not believe this, but we're probably, those of us sitting in this room, are within very much the top 5% of wealth in the world, probably in the top 2%. And this is a really good book that allows us to understand God's perspective. I also have a couple of brochures up here that you're welcome to take. One of them is goes through the what we talked about regarding wills and trusts. What's the difference? What do I need? And this one is about if you ever wanted to become, a supporter for Hume Lake, that would help us. Everything you see is pretty much done by donations. We built this camp on donations. We built buildings through donations. It's not the camperships or your money that you pay to come to conferences. That pays your expenses for being here. But everything else we use through donations. And so this is talking about that. I also have my business card up here if you'd like to get a hold of me, because what I offer to anybody who comes to any of my seminars is a chance to sit down with me, you two, one-on-one, at your home, across the table from you, and just go through your own personal stuff. There's no cost, no obligation. I'll review what you have. I'll give you a review of what you may need or what you don't need. If you need to organize to start and do something from scratch, I'll do that. It's my ministry to you. The way I do that, though, is I travel all over the state, and I do it like I'll be... Next week, I'll be 2 days in the Central Coast area, and I'll be accumulating appointments that I'll go and I'll see people over 2 days. The next week, I may be in the Sacramento area. So wherever you are, if you're in California, I can get to you. It just may take me a couple of months to get to the geographical area where you're going to be. But if that would be of any value to you, I would be happy to do that, to be able to sit down and talk with you. So if you're interested in that, I have some pages up here that you can just sign up. I ask you for your name, your address, email, and phone number. And I really need all of that, because particularly your address and email, because I usually communicate through email, because I found email, I can always get a hold of you through email, where if phone, many times you may not be there. But the address is important, because it helps me also realize geographically where you are, so I can try to put you together with other people geographically. So I'm going to put one of them over on this side. There's one on this side, so more than one can work at a time. So you're welcome to take these. By the way, if you are interested in a treasure principle, these run about $7. But again, if you want the books and you don't have either money with you or you don't have the money, you're welcome to take them. There's no requirement. It's my gift, my ministry to you. Okay, what I forgot to do at the very beginning was to pray. I'm off my game a little bit today, but let's pray as we close, and then I'll be up here and I can answer questions as long as my voice holds out. Father, we just want to thank you and praise you for just the fact that you've allowed us to accumulate assets that we even have to worry about. And God, that we have the privilege of being able to first take care of our children, but also to consider what we might want to do for furthering your kingdom. And God, we just ask for your wisdom, for your guidance. Help us to know what we should do and what we shouldn't do. Help us to have your wisdom regarding all of our finances and the way that we treat them. And God, I just pray that the things that we've talked about today would be things that would be important to the people who are here, and that God, that you would just bless and honor yourself and glorify yourself as a result. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.